It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So think about how you respond to the question, where are you from? Maybe you say Pittsburgh or Sao Paulo or Berlin, but probably not the U.S. or Brazil or Germany, because cities are often the places we most identify with. And over the next 20 or so years, almost two-thirds of us on this planet will live in or around them. Cities are like laboratories, places of experimentation, of possibility. But they're also places with big problems that affect all of us. So on the show today, we're going to explore the big ideas that come out of cities and how those ideas could shape the way our whole world is organized. First up, a story that ends with an idea about improving cities, but it starts in traffic. Specifically, traffic in Boston, Massachusetts, which is where Daniel Quercia had just moved to from London.
The big difference between London and Boston was that not many people were biking in Boston.
This was about 5 years ago, and Daniel was biking. He moved to Boston for a job at MIT. But before that, he'd mostly lived in small towns in Europe, and so...
I feel that I can move better by bike.
Okay, so once he got to Boston, Daniel did what most of us do when we're in a new place and we need to figure out how to get somewhere. He pulled out his smartphone, he opened up the mapping app, and he asked it for the best route. And the mapping app told Daniel that the most efficient way to go, the fastest way, was to take Massachusetts Avenue.
Mass Ave is a big road with a bridge. There are a lot of cars, right? But, I mean, it was the easiest way, right, in terms of landmarks, in terms of orienteering.
Just for the someone. Most direct way.
Exactly.
But not pleasant.
Not pleasant at all.
Not only were there no bike lanes...
Then usually the traffic lights were optimized for car traffic.
Which made certain intersections hard to cross.
So it was a bit a stressful experience to go through that road.
Daniel was choking on exhaust fumes. He was weaving in and out of traffic. It was fast, but not so fun. So after a few weeks of this, he started to think.
Maybe it was not a conscious process. It was more like I got fed up of the same, doing the same. So I just said, no, I might try a different road.
So one morning, Daniel left his house and he ignored the mapping app. He just stuck to the side streets, the alleys, those little one-way roads that he never really bothered with before. And what happened next? Here's Daniel on the TED stage.
I just remember a feeling of surprise. Surprise at finding a street with no cars, as opposed to the nearby Mass Ave full of cars. Surprise at finding a street draped by the leaves and surrounded by trees. For an entire month, I was trapped in my mobile app that the journey to work became one thing only, the shortest path. In this single journey, there was no thought of enjoying the road, no pleasure in connecting with nature, no possibility of looking people in the eyes. And why? Because I was saving a minute out of my commute.
So that day, just like going a different way, it just took a few minutes longer, but I mean, it seems like it changed the whole experience of the city for you.
It changes the experience because you can look at shops, you can look at little things that make the difference.
Like the perspective of buildings.
The perspective of buildings, and also just the very fact to look at people's eyes, you kind of have the human contact. And as a human, right, we are social animals, and that's what we need.
Daniel Quercia happens to be a computer scientist, and he uses data to find solutions to the kinds of everyday challenges humans face, things like the best way to get from point A to point B. So after he took that different route on his bike and found a more pleasant way to get to work, Daniel began to wonder how he could maybe use the power of data to focus less on efficiency.
Now, let me ask you, how many of you have never used a mapping app for finding directions? Most of you, if not all, have. And don't get me wrong, mapping apps are the greatest game changers for encouraging people to explore the city. You take your phone out and you know immediately where to go. However, the app also assumes there are only a handful of directions to destination. It has the power to make those handful of directions the definitive direction to that destination. Einstein once said, logic will get you from A to B. Imagination will take you everywhere. So with a bit of imagination, we needed to understand which parts of the city people find beautiful. Based on that idea, we built a crowdsourcing platform, a web game. Players are shown pairs of urban scenes, and they're asked to choose which one is more beautiful, quiet, and happy. Based on thousands of user votes, then we are able to see where consensus emerges. We're able to see which are the urban scenes that make people happy.
And soon after Daniel built that crowdsourcing platform, he and his research colleagues made a web app that would allow users to tag photos of urban scenes around their city as either beautiful or quiet or happy. And they fed that data into a mapping application. And they called the project Happy Maps.
So right now we have a website where you in London where you can input, like you do in Google Maps, you have point A and point B, and it's going to give you two options. So one option is the shortest path, and the other is the most pleasurable path.
The happy path.
Yes, exactly.
You know, we hear a lot about like smart cities, right? These places that are designed for ultra efficiency. But I mean, why don't people who design those cities, you know, think more about making them enjoyable?
Because of their mindset. There are engineers like I am, and our work, it's all about efficient way of solving problems. So think about the corporate rhetoric behind smart city, right? Is saying, okay, when you go to work, you're always on time. When you go shopping, there is no queue, and you know what? You're going to feel really, really safe because of the CCTV cameras around you.
Yeah.
Now, efficiency, security, they're important, and they make a city acceptable, but they don't make a city great. In reality, what we need to maximize is not efficiency, but we need to maximize experience of people and ultimately well-being.
Daniel Quercia now lives in Cambridge, England, where he runs the social dynamics team at Bell Labs. You can check out his TED Talk at TED.com. And you can also find out more info there about his Happy Maps project and others.
Right now, we are working on a project that is called Smelly Maps.
As in smell, the smelly parts of
yes,
the city.
Yes, Smelly Maps.
Wow.
Where okay. Basically we map the entire smellscape of the city through Ooh. The pictures that people leave. So you take a picture in the park and then you annotate it with the words violet and rose.
Smelly maps, they could be coming soon to a city near you. On the show today, building better cities.
The idea of a city goes to the heart, I think, of what it means to be a human being.
This is Benjamin Barber. He's a senior research scholar at the City University of New York. And Benjamin has spent a lot of his professional life studying what makes cities special and why we're attracted to them.
Human beings are sociable. They like being with other human beings. They're creative, which we tend to do together. They're imaginative, which is, again, a community thing.
Yeah.
The city, the township, is a natural expression, a natural manifestation of that social instinct that we have. And cities define us. It's where we're born, get educated, grow up, get married, where we pray and play, where we get old and where we die.
Benjamin Barber believes the most challenging problems we face around the world, disease, poverty, terrorism, they're solvable, but they're also really big. So they require a whole new approach. Here's Benjamin on the TED stage.
Democracy is in trouble, no question about that. It's increasingly irrelevant to the kinds of decisions we face that have to do with global pandemics, a cross-border problem, with markets and immigration, something that goes beyond national borders, with terrorism, with war, all now cross-border problems. In fact, we live in a 21st century world of interdependence. And when we look for solutions in politics and in democracy, we are faced with political institutions designed 400 years ago. 21st century, transnational world of problems and challenges, 17th century world of political institutions. In that dilemma lies the central problem of democracy. And my suggestion is that we change the subject, that we stop talking about nations, about bordered states, and we start talking about cities.
So, why cities? Well, a few years ago, Benjamin was trying to figure out how governments could tackle huge problems around the world.
So I began to look around and say, well, where in the modern world can we find political institutions where democracy still kind of works? And it was there that I came to this old, old notion of the human community, because we see in local government a palpable, touchable form of government. You know, local government is democratic government. That's what government's supposed to be about. So it was the sense that cities still function with some resemblance to democracy in a way that no other political institutions do. I love the example of, you know, people say, when you ask young people today, you know, about democracy, they're cynical. They don't believe in it. They don't trust democracy. But when you come to the town, to the city, to the neighborhood, then these people say, yeah, I get that. Yeah, that I still kind of believe in. That still kind of works.
Now, of course, that's not true everywhere. Not every city, town, or neighborhood works great for the people who live there. But some of them do, a lot of them do. And when we come back, where those places are, and what lessons they might hold for the rest of us, wherever we live.
Some of the worst scourges we face, those problems can be solved by responsible municipal governments, cities, and mayors working together.
I'm Guy Raz. Our show today, Ideas About Building Better Cities. Stay with us. You're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas about building better cities. So we were just hearing from Benjamin Barber, and he believes that cities hold lessons for solving some of the world's biggest problems. And he also thinks that the mayors who run those cities, they could actually lead the way for the rest of us. That's because mayors have an advantage that presidents and prime ministers don't.
My premise is that a mayor and a prime minister are at the opposite ends of a political spectrum. To be a prime minister or president, you have to have an ideology. But mayors are pragmatists. They're problem solvers. Real city mayors have to get things done. They have to put ideology and religion and ethnicity aside and draw their cities together. We saw this a couple of decades ago when Teddy Kollek, the great mayor of Jerusalem in the 80s and the 90s, was besieged one day in his office by religious leaders. They were arguing with one another about access to the holy sites. And the squabble went on, and Kollek listened, and he finally said, "Gentlemen, spare me your sermons, and I will fix your sewers." That's what mayors do. They fix sewers. They get the trains running. There isn't a left or right way of doing. Boris Johnson in London calls himself an anarcho-Tory. He's an anarchist. He rides to work on a bike, but at the same time, he's in some ways a conservative. Bloomberg in New York was a Democrat. Then he was a Republican. And finally, he was an independent and said, the party label just gets in the way. Lushkov, 20 years mayor in Moscow, though he helped found a party, United Party, with Putin, in fact, refused to be defined by the party. So mayors are pragmatists and problem solvers.
When you think about, you know, all the challenges in the world, like things like climate change, right? What is it that cities or, you know, specifically mayors can do that countries can't?
Well, just let me do a tiny piece of political theory. Nation states made a promise through the social contract to their citizens, which was rooted in their sovereignty. They said, if you obey us, you can elect us and so on, but you have to obey the laws of the sovereign nation. We will guarantee your life, your liberty, your estate and property, what today we would call your sustainability. But in the last 50 or 60 years, states can no longer fulfill the sovereign promise that we will take care of you, we will sustain our citizens. And that's where cities have increasingly said, if you can't and won't, then we have to. And that's why, in particularly in this urgent area of climate change, cities, more than 80 or 90% of which are on water, cities have the responsibility to say, someone's got to deal with climate change because our citizens and our cities are going to be the first to go underwater. And there are all kinds of ways in which cities working one by one, but better when they collaborate, can address climate change.
80% of carbon emissions come from cities, which means cities are in a position to solve the carbon problem, or most of it, whether or not the states of which they are a part make agreements with one another. And they are doing it. Los Angeles cleaned up its port, which was 40% of carbon emissions. New York has a program to upgrade its old buildings, make them better insulated in the winter, to not leak energy in the summer. That's having an impact. Bogota introduced a transportation system that saved energy, that allowed surface buses to run in effect like subways, express buses with corridors. There's Singapore, as it developed its high rise and its remarkable public housing, also developed an island of parks. And if you go there, you'll see how much of it is greenland and parkland. Cities are sharing what they do, and they are making a difference by shared best practices. Bike shares, many of you have heard of it, started 20, 30 years ago in Latin America. Now it's in hundreds of cities around the world. Pedestrian zones, congestion fees, emission limits in cities like California cities have. There's lots and lots that cities can do, even when opaque, stubborn nations refuse to act.
Benjamin Barber wrote a book laying out an idea of how cities around the world could band together to solve really big problems. It's called If Mayors Ruled the World. And in that book, he lays out this proposal, an actual organization, a global parliament, a gathering of mayors from all over the world.
When mayors visit one another, you have, in effect, a small working group solving problems, not a ritualistic meeting of different ideologies, which leads to the idea of a global parliament of mayors, with cities beginning to say, we will do what sovereign nations can't.
But how would a parliament of mayors work?
Well, I have a template, I have a plan that suggests how that might happen, but obviously that will be something that mayors themselves will have to deal with. And next year, when the inaugural parliament of mayors actually takes place, one of the first questions will be the governance question. What is absolutely indispensable to start with, though, is the political will of cities and their citizens to say, it is our time now, it is our time to ask these questions and provide answers, and we can only do that when we work together.
The road to global democracy doesn't run through states. It runs through cities. We can create a global parliament of mayors. It's in my conception of the coming world, but it's also on the table in city halls in Seoul, Korea, in Amsterdam, in Hamburg, and in New York. Mayors are considering that idea of how you can actually constitute a global parliament of mayors. And I love that idea because a parliament of mayors is a parliament of citizens, and a parliament of citizens is a parliament of us. Thank you so much, my fellow citizens.
That's Benjamin Barber. By the way, the first meeting of the Global Parliament of Mayors is scheduled for 2016. You can see Benjamin's entire talk at TED.com. So speaking of mayors, a couple weeks ago, the mayor of Atlanta was having a pretty busy morning.
This morning, I met with a brigadier general from the Army Corps of Engineers, a briefing with the local head of the FBI regarding terrorism and security. I did a video for a woman who is turning 80 years old.
For Mayor Kasim Reed, the items on this to-do list may seem really different, but they're actually kind of the same.
All of them deal with the tapestry of the city. And I guarantee you that the video that I did for Myrna White's mom is as important as the briefing that I had on our jobs numbers this morning.
Kasim Reed actually came to this realization back in 2009. He was running for mayor at the time, and he was losing pretty badly, actually. So he started to knock on a lot of doors. Mayor Reed picks up the story from the TED stage.
On one hot day in July, though, I was in a neighborhood in Atlanta called Mechanicsville. So I knocked on this door. I had my spiel down. Hello, I'm Kasim Reed. I'm a Georgia State Senator, and I'd like to be your mayor. May I talk to you about the campaign? And this wonderful old woman with a warm face looked at me through a door that had steel bars on it. She said, come on over here, baby. Talk to me. Tell me why you think you should be Mayor Kashif. I said, it's Kasim, but it's okay. And I said, Atlanta is the cradle of the civil rights movement. We have the third largest concentration of Fortune 500 businesses. We have the busiest passenger airport in the world. We have wonderful restaurants, and I believe that I can make the city stronger. And she looked at me as if I was a Martian. She grabbed my hand. She said, come here, baby. Let me show the Atlanta that I know. She took me out her door, and she pointed at a pool across the way. And in that pool were about 4 to 5 young boys, and they were literally shooting dice in a pool that should have been filled with water. If you looked left, you saw a gazebo that used to be used by people for picnics that was full of guys playing music that was way too loud with gang graffiti on the gazebos. She said, that's the Atlanta that I know, baby. She said, let me tell you something else. I'm a pretty good cook myself, so I don't go to the restaurants you're talking about. And if I was going to go to restaurants, I'd need to take the bus, and I don't really feel safe going out at night right now. And she said, that airport that you all are always talking about, baby, I don't fly. Now, you have a nice day. And then that steel door hit, bam! And I was like, I spent 15 minutes, I don't even think I got the vote, and I really don't think she liked me. But I changed that day. Because what I understood from that visit with Ms. Davis was that until you see a city how people who are most in need of help see it, you're never going to reach them. And I was never the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you were thinking about Atlanta from like a 30,000-foot vantage point, right? Like a lot of politicians do. And then she like pulled you back down, made you see the city like she sees it, you know, from the point of view of her neighborhood.
You're exactly right. And what I learned that day is what you really have to do when you're trying to lead people is find out what they care about and what needle they want moved. And so I said that if I ever got elected mayor, I was going back to Oakland City Park and I was going to fix it. But I think that if you don't take care of the basics and do them very well, make sure that the finances of the city are well run, make sure that you provide police services, pick up trash, fix potholes, that you will never be able to do anything aspirational. And once you take on those issues and solve them, the public will then allow you to spend resources on the things that you care about.
You know, we were just hearing from Benjamin Barber about how mayors have this huge advantage over national politicians. What do you think it is that allows mayors to get things done?
Speed and closeness to the public. If you compare or contrast that to the way that states move, we won't even have a conversation about the way that the national government moves. And so in Atlanta, all you need to do to shift the direction of something is have my support and the support of 8 members of the Atlanta City Council.
That's it.
And so if you spread that across the 50 largest metros in the U.S., you're actually impacting about 70% of the population and about 75% of GDP.
Wow.
And so as government's resources are more and more strained, Cities are finding creative ways to take on challenges and meet needs. And so that's why I think they're so exciting.
And you're just another, like, resident of the city. I mean, you are kind of governing the people who are your neighbors.
I don't think that there's any question about it. I think that cities are where you can see your mayor in a grocery store and have an actual conversation about a real problem. And I've been in a grocery store and had someone tell me about a series of vacant houses. And rather than going home, driven by the houses that they pointed out, and ordered code enforcement to that location. And I tell you, when people come in my office and we're able to resolve their challenge or move the needle or make them feel better, it is intensely personal and direct.
Folks, cities are where hope meets the street. And if you don't want to spend your whole life waiting to change something, I happen to believe that you ought to be in cities. You pick an issue, and we are dealing with those issues head on at cities. And I didn't forget about Ms. Davis and Mechanicsville. We opened up every single recreation center in the city of Atlanta when 2/3 of them had been shut when I took office. Cities is where hope meets the street, you all. So because of the strength of the city's finances, we were able to bring back something called the Atlanta Senior Citizens Ball. And we have thousands of wonderful seniors who put on their best clothing, wonderful gowns. And my mother made me change the name from the Senior Citizens Ball to the Forever Young Ball because she didn't like being called a senior. But about 2 years ago, you all, I actually saw Mrs. Davis coming into the ball in a lovely gown. And I actually walked up to her and she gave me a hug. She said, "Hey, baby." I said, "How am I doing?" She said, "You're doing okay. And we're doing okay. And you feel that pull." I looked at her, choked up a bit, and watched her walk off. And I wondered, did she know that on that moment on her porch so many months ago, that she helped to make a mayor and that she changed the city? I hope she knows now. Thank you.
Kasim Reed, he is the mayor of Atlanta, Georgia. You can see his full talk at TED.com. On the show today, ideas about building better cities and how they could improve life for all of us. So up until now, we've been hearing about cities as these engines of innovation and creativity, as these places where human interactions lead to incredible things. But unfortunately, that is not the whole story.
I think that we're hypnotized about the promise of cities, and we're mesmerized by these extraordinarily livable cities in North America and parts of Western Europe.
This is Robert Mugga.
But the vast majority of the world's population doesn't live in those cities. In fact, most people live in Africa, in Asia, in Latin America. And that's where virtually all of future population growth, especially in cities, is going to take place.
Robert travels the developing world, and he looks at how cities in those places are growing and why so many of them are struggling with violence and crime. And he studies how those cities are trying to figure out how to tackle those problems. Here's Robert Mugga on the TED stage.
For the last 20 years, I've been working in countries and cities ripped apart by conflict, violence, terrorism, or some insidious combination of all. I've tracked gun smugglers from Russia to Somalia. I've worked with warlords in Afghanistan and the Congo. I've counted cadavers in Colombia, in Haiti, in Sri Lanka, and Papua New Guinea. Some diplomats and development experts and specialists, they talk about 40 to 50 fragile states that will shape security in the 21st century. I think it's fragile cities which will define the future of order and disorder. Aleppo, Bamako, Caracas, Erbil, Mosul, Tripoli, Salvador, violence is migrating to the metropole. That's because warfare and humanitarian action are going to be concentrated in our cities. And the fight for development, whether you define that as eradicating poverty Universal health care, beating back climate change will be won or lost in the shantytown slums and favelas of our cities.
Can you describe a fragile city that you've been to and what it's like?
So I live in Rio de Janeiro, which in some ways, you know, straddles the idea of a global gateway city as well as a fragile city. And it's a wonderful city, you know, on the one hand. It's a city of samba, it's a city of tourism, it's a beautiful city. On the other hand, it's a city of extraordinary inequality, where, you know, high-rises abut some of the most depraved and poor neighborhoods one could possibly fathom, where you have high rates of violence, you know, I mean, levels of violence that are equivalent in some places to war zones. So I have a complex and contested relationship with the city that seems to be, on the one hand, to thrive, and the other hand, seems to always plumb the depths and seem to devour itself.
So how can a city survive that sort of struggle, even thrive in the face of crime and corruption? Robert Mugga returns with answers in a moment. On the show today, Building Better Cities. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas about building better cities. And we were just hearing from Robert Mugga. He studies some of the most fragile cities in the world, these places where crime and violence can threaten the entire city's survival. But Robert is also looking at how those cities are tackling those problems.
You know, although I live and occupy a realm of a certain measure of pessimism, I am optimistic when I look at some of the inspired leadership of mayors around the world who've managed to turn things around.
How much do you sort of believe in this idea that solutions come from cities, that actually things that are kind of developed locally are often, you know, the best way of handling problems?
Yeah, and I think where you've seen some of the greatest innovation coming from fragile cities is in thinking differently about the structure of the city and how different parts of the city interact, by bringing low-income areas in contact with high-income areas, by rethinking transportation to make transportation much more predictable and accessible, by building not just haphazard public, you know, utilities or community centers or libraries, but really investing in top-notch and high-quality public infrastructure to get people who live in that city to feel like they're part of the city, to feel like they own the city. We got to get away from this model of segregation, exclusion, and cities with walls. My favorite example of how to do this comes from Medellin. When I lived in Colombia in the late 1990s, Medellin was the murder capital of the world. But it changed course, and it did this by deliberately investing in its low-income and most violent areas and integrating them with a middle-class one through a network of cable cars, of public transport, and first-class infrastructure. And in the process, it dropped homicide by 79% in just under two decades. There's wonderful work that's happening that I've been involved with in Kingston, Jamaica, and right here in Rio, which is putting education, employment, recreation up front for these high-risk groups. And as a result, we're seeing violence going down in their communities. We can also focus on hotspots. Did you know that between 1 and 2% of street addresses in any fragile city can predict up to 99% of violent crime? Take the case of Sao Paulo, where I've been working. It's gone from being Brazil's most dangerous city to one of its safest. And it did this by doubling down on information collection, hotspot mapping, and police reform. And in the process, it dropped homicide by 70% in just over 10 years.
You describe the case of Sao Paulo, you mentioned Kingston, Jamaica, and Rio. Have you seen, you know, like these kinds of approaches spread to other fragile cities?
Yeah, and that, I guess that's why I'm kind of hopeful. I think this information technology revolution has meant that there's been almost a democratization of these kinds of tools used both by police but also by citizens, not just in the West, but spread out through the South and East. And so some of the most inspiring and I think exciting examples of the use of these tools are happening in cities that are ostensibly fragile, as, you know, as in Medellin or Sao Paulo or Rio or even in Nairobi and other parts of Africa.
Yeah, because, I mean, cities are laboratories. I mean, they are, even fragile cities are laboratories. I mean, they're places where big-scale problems can be tackled or can be attempted to be tackled.
I think that's right. And so I think what we're seeing now is, and it's an exciting evolution, is that it's no longer just Mayor Bloomberg who's coming down to, you know, Rio de Janeiro or Bogota to explain to them the wonders of the New York model. It's actually Mayor Peñalosa from Bogota who's traveling around Africa, Asia, and Latin America explaining how they went about dealing with insecurity and violence and fragility in their cities. And in some ways, providing a more compelling vision than those that have been expanded from the north.
Are there examples of things happening in some of these fragile cities that are kind of being observed by mayors in more prosperous cities, and they're saying, hey, that's kind of cool, like, we should try this out?
Pretty much every day we have a request here in Rio for people to come from as far away as Baltimore and Chicago, but also most recently from Bangkok. Basically, groups of mayors and police chiefs and public transport officials who are seeking to extract ideas from the innovations that are taking place, even right here in Rio de Janeiro. This is an example, really, of this idea of the North and South becoming blurred. The line separating, you know, the New Yorks from the Sao Paulos are beginning to disappear. If I have one single message for you, it's this. There's nothing inevitable about lethal violence. And we can make our cities safer. We have the opportunity of a lifetime to drop homicidal violence in half within our lifetime. So I have just one question. What are we waiting for? Thank you.
Robert Mugga is research director for the Igarapé Institute, which is a security think tank in Rio de Janeiro. You can see his entire TED Talk at TED.com. On the show today, ideas about building better cities, what makes them work, and how they can thrive. And for former City Commissioner of New York, Amanda Burden, cities aren't defined by skyscrapers or roads, but by their public spaces.
Public spaces create value. And if you create a public space that people want to be, it can actually change the value around that space.
And a good example of this in New York is Bryant Park. This is a place where, in the 1980s, you did not want to wander in there.
It was the greatest drug den in the entire city. You couldn't see into it, and if you were into it, you couldn't see out of it. That's why it was a perfect place for drug dealers, because they could do whatever they wanted to do undercover.
That made it a very scary place, which made the surrounding neighborhood scary as well. People didn't even want to go to the nearby New York Public Library because they were worried about being mugged. But that changed when an urbanologist named William Holly White,
one of the most incredible people I've ever known in my life, who really changed my life,
said, this is an easy fix.
So he proposed solutions, which was to take down the hedges around the edge of it and make it so you could see it from the outside.
This is what Bryant Park sounds like today.
All of a sudden, Bryant Park became one of the most desirable addresses for companies in the entire city of New York. And now it's one of the great public spaces of all time.
Just attention to little details made a kind of a sketchy park into this place where people wanted to actually have their lunch breaks. And so instead of putting in things like fixed benches, Holly White said, put in tables and chairs that you could move around.
You can watch people do this. They come into the space, and they put their hands on the back of the chair, and they just move it about an inch or two.
It becomes their own space.
Exactly. And then they sit down, and they're comfortable.
What happened in Bryant Park was so inspiring to Amanda that about 20 years later, when she became the city commissioner of New York, her mission was to remake great public spaces. Because to her, that's what helps cities thrive. Here's Amanda's TED Talk.
When people think about cities, they tend to think of certain things. They think of buildings and streets and skyscrapers, noisy cabs. But when I think about cities, I think about people. Cities are fundamentally about people. And where people go and where people meet are at the core of what makes a city work. So even more important than buildings in a city are the public spaces in between them. And today, some of the most transformative changes in cities are happening in these public spaces.
How do public spaces transform cities?
Cities are meant to be for people. They're meant as places for people to come together. Otherwise, people feel alone and isolated in a city, and they won't feel a sense of safety and comfort and belonging, because public spaces really are the glue that holds a city together, and they're what make people want to live in a city and stay in a city.
What makes a great public space?
Well, they have to have many places to sit, different choices of places to sit. And they have to have greenery, not only a canopy of a tree, but you feel greenery at the ground plane. So you actually feel in a healthy environment. And the details are also so important. If you just have a bench in a public space that has no back to it, it's really kind of useless because you can't read your book. If you'll find a developer will build a bench, yes, but it will be only 13 inches wide. So you can't really sit on it and you have to perch. All of these details are important, and all of these elements make people feel invited into a public space.
I was determined to create places that would make a difference in people's lives. There were 2 miles of abandoned, degraded waterfront in the neighborhoods of Greenpoint and Williamsburg in Brooklyn. Impossible to get to and impossible to use. And I spent an incredible amount of time on every square inch of these plans. I wanted to make sure that there were tree-lined paths from the upland to the water, and of course, lots and lots of places to sit. Honestly, I had no idea how it would turn out. I had to have faith. But I put everything that I had studied and learned into those plans. And then it opened. And I have to tell you, it was incredible. People came from all over the city to be in these parks. I know they changed the lives of the people who lived there, but they also changed New Yorkers' whole image of their city. I often come down and watch people get on this little ferry that now runs between the boroughs. And I can't tell you why, but I'm completely moved by the fact that people are using it as if it had always been there.
If you think about the New York that you live in today and the New York you lived in, you know, 20 or more years ago, it's in some ways a different place, isn't it?
It's a very different place. One of the first reasons it's a different place is if you think back 15 years ago, when people thought of New York City, they thought just of Manhattan. They didn't think, as they do now, of Brooklyn as almost the center of New York City.
Yeah.
We didn't think about our waterfront in 2000. And that was, I think, one of the things I'm most proud of as city planning commissioner for Mike Bloomberg, was to not only recapture the waterfront, put parks on the waterfront. And the goal was to have the water become part of New Yorkers' everyday lives. And now there are little ferries that run between each borough so that the water becomes our connective tissue and the way I like to think of it as our greatest open space.
Do you have a favorite public space in New York?
Well, yes, I do. I do, and I'm very emotional about this space because I have really put my heart into it, and it's the High Line.
The High Line, before it was a popular park in New York, was an old, abandoned, elevated railroad. And when Amanda first saw it in 2000, it was slated for demolition.
And the amazing thing about it was when I was brought up there by the two young men who discovered it, it had become a self-seeded landscape, kind of a garden in the sky.
Amanda says right then she fell in love with the High Line. And part of what makes it so special is that when you walk along it, you see the city from this unique vantage point.
It's just at the right elevation at 23 feet in the air. So sometimes if you look on the axis of streets, you can see straight to the Hudson River, that you can see inland to the city. You can see the Empire State Building. You can see the city from a whole new vantage point.
The High Line, even though it is widely known now, and phenomenally popular, it is the most contested public space in the city. I mean, you might see a beautiful park, but not everyone does. You know, it's true. Commercial interests will always battle against public space. I mean, you might say, how wonderful it is that more than 4 million people come from all over the world to visit the High Line. Well, a developer sees just one thing, customers. Hey, why not take out those plantings and have shops all along the High Line? Wouldn't that be terrific? And won't it mean a lot more money for the city? Well, no, it would not be terrific. It would be a mall and not a park. And you know what? It might mean more money for the city, but the city has to take the long view, the view for the common good. Most recently, the last section of the High Line, the third section of the High Line, the final section of the High Line has been pitted against development interest, where some of the city's leading developers are building more than 17 million square feet at the Hudson Yards. And they came to me and proposed that they temporarily disassemble that third and final section. You know, perhaps the High Line didn't fit in with their image of a gleaming city of skyscrapers on a hill. Perhaps it was just in their way. In any case, it took 9 months of nonstop daily negotiation to finally get the signed agreement to prohibit its demolition. And that was only 2 years ago. So you see, no matter how popular and successful a public space may be, it can never be taken for granted.
I mean, it seems to me like the whole idea of a city and what makes a city special is it is a place for all kinds of people to interact, to bump into each other, to communicate.
Yes, a city has to be opportunity for everyone. Not only for housing, for jobs, a place where you can climb the ladder and make your own business. And I would say it's also a city that's fun. Fun for everyone.
So, what's the trick? How do you turn a park into a place that people want to be? Well, it's up to you. Not as a city planner, but as a human being. You don't tap into your design expertise. You tap into your humanity. I mean, would you want to go there? Would you want to stay there? Can you see into it and out of it? Are there other people there? Does it seem green and friendly? Can you find your very own seat? Public space can change how you live in a city, how you feel about a city, whether you choose one city over another. And public space is one of the most important reasons why you stay in a city. I believe that a successful city is like a fabulous party. People stay because they are having a great time. Thank you.
That's Amanda Burden, the former city commissioner for New York. She's now a principal at Bloomberg Associates, where she travels around the world helping cities rethink their public spaces. You can see her entire talk at TED.com. Find a city, find myself a city to live in. I will find a city, find myself a city to live in. Hey, thanks for listening to our show on cities this week. If you want to find out more about who was on it, you can go to ted.npr.org. You can also find hundreds more TED Talks at TED.com. Our production staff at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, Sanaz Meshkinpour, and Casey Herman, with help from Daniel Shukin. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading here on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey!